You're listening to a podcast from York City Church. If you like what you hear and you would like to find out more, please visit our website at www.yorkcitychurch.org.uk.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome. Do come in and get your seats. We're continuing in our series in Abraham. Genesis 19 today. So far in our series through the life of Abraham in Genesis, we've realized that we aren't just reading the story of what happened then. We are reading the story of what happened then, but the Bible is God's book, and it is alive. And so the stories that are here for a reason. We've already seen something of that in our worship this morning, haven't we? That one person's story can in some ways be the story of us all. So as well as reading stories about what happened then, at times it's almost as if the Holy Spirit is reading you your story through these accounts of God's relationship with Abraham. Maybe you've had one of those moments when you've realized, hang on, I think he's talking about me. The story that we find here turns out to be the story that we find here and here. And this can be intimidating at times, can't it? Because what we read here, as it reflects on us, isn't necessarily positive. But that doesn't mean it's bad news. There are no good stories without struggle, without conflict, without moments of almost certain disaster that are brought round by their author to happily ever after. There are no heroes who don't have to overcome some kind of weakness, failure, or challenge on their heroic journey. Now, I say this because today's text is the point in the story when we will all want to distance ourselves from what we read, more than ever before, perhaps, because today's story has some particularly low points. In disgust, in anger, we may be tempted to think, that's got nothing to do with me, mate. As we read the story today, be disgusted, be angry. That is how we're supposed to react. And then wait in the tension of the story to see what happens next. Jesus said, unless a grain of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only a single seed. But if it dies, it produces many seeds. Now, I'm going to read Genesis 19. It's not going to come up on the screens just yet. You can just listen to the story. You can follow along if you want on your devices or in your Bibles. Let's hear the word of God. The two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them and bowed himself with his face to the earth and said, "My lords, please turn aside to your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet. Then you may rise up early and go on your way." They said, "No, we will spend the night in the town square." But he pressed them strongly. So they turned aside to him and entered his house. And he made them a feast and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. But before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both young and old, all the people to the last man, surrounded the house. And they called to Lot, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us, that we may know them." Lot went out to the men at the entrance, shut the door after him, and said, "I beg you, my brothers, do not act so wickedly. Behold, I have two daughters who have not known any man. What are you doing, Lot? Let me bring them out to you, and do to them as you please. Only do nothing to these men, for they have come under the shelter of my roof." But they said, "Stand back." And they said, "This fellow came to sojourn. He's a foreigner, he's an immigrant, and he's become the judge. Now we will deal worse with you than with them." And they pressed hard against the man Lot and drew near to break the door down. But the angel men inside the house reached out their hands and brought Lot into the house with them and shut the door, and they struck with blindness the men who were at the entrance of the house, both small and great, so that they wore themselves out, groping at the door. Then the angel men said to Lot, "Have you anyone else here, sons-in-law, sons, daughters, or anyone you have in the city? Bring them out of the place, for we are about to destroy this place, because the outcry against its people has become great before the Lord, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it." So Lot went out and said to his sons-in-law, who were to marry his daughters, "Up, get out of this place, for the Lord is about to destroy the city." But he seemed to his sons-in-law to be joking. As morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, saying, "Up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be swept away in the punishment of the city." But Lot lingered. So the men seized him and his wife and his two daughters by the hand, the Lord being merciful to him. And they brought him out and set him outside the city. And as they brought them out, one said, "Escape for your life. Do not look back or stop anywhere in the valley. Escape to the hills, lest you be swept away." And Lot said to them, "Oh no, my lords. Behold, your servant has found favor in your sight, and you've shown me great kindness in saving my life. But I cannot escape to the hills, lest the disaster overtake me and I die. Behold, this city is near enough to flee to, and it's a little one. Let me escape there, it's only a little one, and my life will be saved." He said to them, the angel men said to them, "Behold, I grant you this favor also, that I will not overthrow the city of which you have spoken. Escape there quickly, for I can do nothing till you arrive there." Therefore the name of that city is Zoar. The sun had risen on the earth when Lot came to Zoar. Then the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah sulfur and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the valley and all the inhabitants of the cities and what grew on the ground. But Lot's wife behind him looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. And Abraham went early in the morning to the place where he had stood before the Lord. And he looked down from Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the valley. And he looked, and behold, the smoke of the land went up like the smoke of a furnace. So it was that when God destroyed the cities of the valley, God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow, when he overthrew the cities in which Lot had lived. Now Lot went out of Zoar and lived in the hills with his two daughters, for he was afraid to live in Zoar. So he lived in a cave with his two daughters. And the firstborn said to the younger, "Our father is old, and there is not a man on earth to come into us after the manner of all the earth. Come, let us make our father drink wine, and we'll lie with him, that we may preserve offspring from our father." So they made their father drink wine that night, and the firstborn went in and lay with her father. He did not know when she lay down or when she got up. The next day, the firstborn said to the younger, "Behold, last night I lay with my father. Let us make him drink wine tonight also. Then you go in and lie with him, that we may preserve offspring from our father." So they made their father drink wine that night also. And the younger arose and lay with him. And he did not know when she lay down or got up. Thus both the daughters of Lot became pregnant by their father. The firstborn bore a son and called his name Moab. He is the father of the Moabites to this day, to the time of writing. The younger also bore a son and called his name Ben-Ammi. He is the father of the Ammonites to this day. Okay, take a deep breath. Let's orient ourselves in the story for a minute. Lot is Abraham's nephew, remember that? Back at the end of chapter 11, we learn that Lot's dad died young. And then when Abraham leaves his homeland in response to God's call, he takes his nephew Lot with him. It seems like Abraham, to some extent, took Lot under his wing, perhaps because he didn't have a son of his own, and perhaps because Lot's father had died young. And then a little time later, Abraham and Lot parted company because they had too much stuff to occupy the same land. And Abraham gave Lot his pick of the land, and Lot chooses the best land. He goes to the east into the Jordan Valley, and Abraham goes to the west and settles in Canaan. The writer tells us that Lot went as far east as Sodom, and then adds, "The men of Sodom were wicked, great sinners against the Lord." And then in chapter 18, last week, the Lord and his two angels meet with Abraham and his wife Sarah, and Abraham makes a great fuss for his honored guests, as was expected in that culture. And the Lord tells them, Abraham and Sarah, about their future miracle child again. And Sarah thinks it's just all a bit too much. She thinks it's laughable. Then the Lord tells Abraham that he's going on to see just how wicked the people of Sodom and Gomorrah are. And the two other angel men do that. They go on to Sodom. But Abraham stops the Lord in his tracks and tries with all of his might to talk the Lord out of destroying the city of Sodom. And the Lord agrees that he will not destroy the city of Sodom if there are 10 righteous people there. And that's where chapter 18 picks up the story. Let me read to us again the first few verses of the chapter. The two angels came to Sodom in the evening. Now, there are two points in this chapter that stand out to me more than any other and that demand some attention, more attention than all the rest. There's so much in here, but it's these two points in the story that I want us to focus on. And the first point is in this first chunk of text that I'm about to read. It's the "what are you doing, Lot?" part of the story. The two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them and bowed himself with his face to the earth and said, "My lords, please turn aside to your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet. Then you may rise up early and go on your way." They said, "No, we will spend the night in the square." They're there to see how wicked the city of Sodom is. But he pressed them strongly. Why doesn't he want them to sleep in the square? It doesn't take long to find out. They turned aside to him and entered his house, and he made them a feast and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. But before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both young and old, all the people to the last man surrounded the house, and they called to Lot, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them." And Lot went out to the men at the entrance, shut the door after him, and said, "I beg you, my brothers, do not act so wickedly. Behold, I have two daughters who have not known any man. Let me bring them out to you and do to them as you please." "What are you doing, Lot? Only do nothing to these men, for they have come under the shelter of my roof." But they said, "Stand back." And they said, "This fellow came to sojourn, and he's become the judge. Now we will deal worse with you than with them." Then they pressed hard against the man Lot and drew near to break the door down. But the angel men reached out their hands and brought Lot into the house with them and shut the door. And they struck with blindness the men who were at the entrance of the house, both small and great, so that they wore themselves out groping for the door. Lot, what are you doing? Lot has welcomed these two angel men to his city. He's already taken it upon himself to stop them sleeping in the square. In the previous chapter, we saw just how highly hospitality is valued in this culture, didn't we? As with Abraham, so here now with Lot. To have a guest in your house is a great honor. To have an honored guest is an even greater honor. And now that these people are under Lot's roof, his foremost responsibility, as his culture sees it, and as his own need to be upright and respectable demands it, is to protect his guests. That's his foremost responsibility. So much so that he's ready to sacrifice the safety and dignity of his own daughters to preserve his own honor, at least as he understands honor. This is not God's way. This is not in keeping with God's design for the honor and dignity of each human person. Lord, what are you doing? One of the clear conclusions of Genesis 1, the start of this book, is that both man and woman are made in the image of God, that the beauty of one and the beauty of the other belong together. And now we're only in Genesis 19, but God's design has already been ignored so many times, and it's never gone well. Lot says, "I beg you, my brothers, do not act so wickedly." This is bitterly ironic. Do you see the bitter irony in what he's saying? In light of Genesis 1, it couldn't be clearer that Lot's solution to the situation is just as wicked as the evil he's trying to prevent. The men of Sodom want to group sexually assault Lot's guests. But Lot is willing to violate the God-given dignity and value of his own daughters. And my point isn't to ask which is worse. The point is that we're shown that both are utterly evil in the worldview of the author of Genesis. That's very important. So here's our first point of reference. Do we frantically work against one form of evil, blind to our own participation in equally abhorrent attitudes and actions? We can be so blinkered in our self-righteousness, friends. Besides which, the angel men clearly don't need Lot's help, do they? In fact, it's the angel men who have to rescue Lot in a minute. They have to bring him back into the house, and they strike with blindness the men of Sodom. They can handle themselves just fine. God hasn't asked Lot to sacrifice his daughters for the sake of his guests. Now, it seems like Lot is sincere in his concern for his guests, but his concern, however sincere, betrays a ridiculous sense of self-importance. They don't need his help. He thinks he's helping, but he's only adding to the evil he's trying to avoid. Ultimately, it's his own honor that he's concerned with, not that of his honored guests, certainly not that of his daughters, who were equal in dignity and value with him since Genesis 1. So the second point of reference for us, what has God actually asked you to do? He doesn't need you to help him out with things that are none of your business. What has God actually called you to do? Lot's frame of reference is his culture's value system. And it's almost as if his culture's value system conspires with his own sinful selfishness. And he ends up thinking that protecting his guests is more important than protecting his daughters. According to the culture, his daughters are his property for him to use as he wishes. The one in the position of power can withhold dignity and value from the powerless. This is self-concerned conformity to cultural expectations. Self-concerned conformity to cultural expectations. Don't get that on a t-shirt. So the third point of reference for us. What are the cultural values that we have taken on in our own self-interest that encourage us to withhold from others the dignity that has been there since Genesis 1? Which human persons in our society do we value so little so as to deprive them of the dignity that is fundamental to their humanity? Friends, instead of the hypocrisy, the self-importance, and the cultural blindness of Lot, we must pursue clarity, humility, and a biblical worldview as to the value of human life. We must stop demanding that others lay down their lives for us. And we must consider every human life a person worthy of laying down our own lives for. But we don't, do we? I certainly don't. This is one of those tension points in the story. Sit in the tension and wait to see what happens. There is good news. The men of Sodom wear themselves out, groping at the door. Lot is worn out himself by his own need for reputation and control, with a totally deluded estimation as to his own ability to do anything right or good or useful. The writer has shown us that Lot is one of the men of Sodom. He is deluded and helpless and broken, just like them. Moving on, verse 12. Then the men said to Lot, the angel men, have you anyone else here, sons-in-law, sons, daughters, or anyone you have in the city? Bring them out of the place. For we are about to destroy this place because the outcry against its people has become great before the Lord, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it. So Lot went out and said to his sons-in-law, who were to marry his daughters, "Up out of this place, for the Lord is about to destroy the city." But he seemed to his sons-in-law to be joking. Look at what happens when Lot goes to warn his sons-in-law. They think he's joking. Now remember Sarah in chapter 18. Just as Sarah in chapter 18 thought God's promise was laughable, so here Lot's sons-in-law think his warning is laughable. Abraham had had his credibility. He'd wasted his credibility with Sarah. Remember when he'd made her the victim of his selfishness by pretending she was only his sister? It's no wonder Sarah is finding Abraham's conversations with the Lord a bit too much. And Lot has lost his credibility with his sons-in-law because he's no different to the men of Sodom. It's all very well playing one of the lads until you've got something serious to say, right? It's all very well being the joker until you need to be taken seriously. And no one does take you seriously because you've traded your credibility in conformity to whatever culture of triviality you happen to be part of. The culture won't take the church seriously because we're no different to anybody else. Our warnings sound like jokes. But every now and again, we find ourselves modeling something that does get people's attention, that people do want to take seriously, and that's wonderful. Isn't it a gift when you have a genuine conversation with someone for an extended period of time, a heart-to-heart? Isn't it a gift when a group of friends can talk for an extended period of time about something that matters, something that they're concerned about, something that they're passionate about? Now, I don't mean to say that we need to be somber all the time. What I mean to say is that fun is a weak substitute for joy and for genuine relationship, relationships of mutual respect and love. I was in Leeds on Monday night talking with a group of students there, a group of Christian students, and it went quite well. I was pleased with how I spoke. There was a nice turnout, but I came away so dejected, so depressed by the whole thing, because they were just silly. It was like they didn't have any capacity for engaging seriously with anything. And they're university students. It was like they hadn't learned how to love each other. So the best they could do was just have a nice time. Maybe they didn't realize they were men and women made in the image of God with dignity, value, and purpose. Maybe they didn't realize how much God loved them, and so they couldn't love each other. Maybe they didn't realize that they'd been taken seriously by God and could therefore take themselves at least a little more seriously. Now, we can all be too intense at times, right? Myself among them, more than most. It's really good to be able to switch off, to be able to take it easy. From a position of love, you can joke around with people. But okay, you can't argue with this point. In romantic comedies, the comedy serves the romance. Yeah? How lacking in love, how lacking in earnestness must Lot have been for his warning to sound like a joke? Verse 15. As morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, saying, "Up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be swept away in the punishment of the city." But Lot lingered. So the angel men, seized him and his wife and his two daughters by the hand, the Lord being merciful to him, and they brought him out of the city. They set him outside the city. And as they brought them out, one said, "Escape for your life. Do not look back or stop anywhere in the valley. Escape to the hills, lest you be swept away." And Lot said to them, "Oh no, my lords. Behold, your servant has found favor in your sight, and you've shown me great kindness in saving my life, but I cannot escape to the hills, lest the disaster overtake me and I die. Behold, this city is near enough to flee to, and it's a little one. Let me escape there. It's only a little one, and my life will be saved." He said to them, "Behold, I grant you this favor also, that I will not overthrow the city of which you've spoken. Escape there quickly, for I can do nothing till you arrive there. Therefore, the name of the city was called Zoar. What is Lot doing again? Why does he still think he knows best? Why is he lingering? Why is he arguing with the angels about where he should go? Remember Abraham at the end of chapter 18. If there are 50 righteous, 35, 20, 10, it's similar here. Oh, I don't want to go to the hills. I'm a city boy. Can I just not go to this little city over here? It's only a little one. Come on, be reasonable. What's the problem? Why do I have to go to the hills? It won't make that much difference, will it? Remember in chapter 18, God had said to Abraham, yeah, okay, several times. Here, the angel says to Lot, yeah, okay. You can go to your little city if you want. Did you notice as we were reading earlier in verse 30, where does Lot end up? In verse 30, he gets scared living in Zoar, and he ends up living in the hills anyway. The chapter ends with an alarming story, doesn't it? Lot's daughters get him drunk on two consecutive nights and sleep with him so that they can become pregnant. They're worried about their family line ending, and so they take this drastic action. And it seems like it's a tragic acceptance of the lack of dignity and value that they've been afforded by their father and their culture. But without wanting to lay the blame at their feet, it's another example of the characters in our story taking matters into their own hands and willing to leave things to the Lord. This seems to be a key theme across these chapters, doesn't it? Why is it so hard to trust that God knows what he's doing? That God has got this? That he has our best at heart? But having said all of that, it's the Lord's patience with Abraham and Lot and Lot's daughters. Even, you could say, the Lord's flexibility that I think we need to notice. Verse 16, the angel men seized Lot and his wife and his two daughters, the Lord being merciful to them, and brought them out of the city. This is a decisive and strong rescue. But from there, the important step has been taken. There's going to be one more decisive command. Do not look back. But apart from that, notice the patience, even the flexibility of the Lord in Lot's rescue. He wants to go to that little city instead of the hills? Okay. Just get out and don't look back. I think it's important to notice that we can be more prescriptive than God, more pedantic, more uptight when it comes to other people's rescue. Okay, do this and then pray this prayer and then stop doing that and then read this book and then do that and then whatever you do, don't do that. And then if you manage all of that, control freaks like me struggle with control because they don't have it. We should be called out of control freaks, not control freaks, right? To be a control freak is to always be grasping for the control you don't have. It's a trust thing, right? Now, God is actually in control, so he doesn't have to be a control freak. Verse 23. The sun had risen on the earth when Lot came to Zoar. Then the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah sulfur and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the valley and all the inhabitants of the cities and what grew on the ground. But Lot's wife behind him looked back and she became a pillar of salt. There might be one or two of us today who have started well, we've even made it out of the city, but we're about to look back. Please don't look back. Don't give up. Keep on going. There's a whole book in the New Testament, the book of Hebrews, an extended sermon that says to its readers, don't look back, keep on going. It seems like the context the writer of Hebrews is writing into is not any great crisis of faith, but just drift in the life of believers. Don't look back, keep on going. Keep your eyes on the prize, Jesus himself, and run. What is it for you? What would make you want to turn back? What makes you devalue Jesus as the ultimate prize? We're not missing out on anything that's worth having. There's a worship song that says, I have decided to follow Jesus, no turning back, no turning back. I have a friend in Geneva, some of you students met her last year, and she came to Christ from a Muslim background. We were part of the same church in Harrogate a few years ago, and I didn't like this song. I have decided to follow Jesus, no turning back, no turning back. I just found it a little bit grandiose. My worry was, it's probably the kind of people singing that song who are the ones who are going to end up turning back. I have decided to follow Jesus, no turning back. Really? But then my friend who'd come to Christ from a Muslim background asked me, Seb, can we sing this song in church? And I asked her why. I don't like it. And she said, well, because following Jesus is hard. And sometimes I feel like turning back. So we started singing the song. And she'd sing it with tears in her eyes. I have decided to follow Jesus. No turning back. No turning back. Now, this is the second moment in the chapter that stands out for me and that demands our attention. Verse 27, Abraham, remember him? And Abraham went early in the morning to the place where he had stood before the Lord, and he looked down toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the valley. And he looked down, and behold, the smoke of the land went up like the smoke of a furnace. So it was that when God destroyed the cities of the valley, God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow when he overthrew the cities in which Lot had lived. Now, this is strange. What does Abraham think as he looks down on the cities of the valley and sees them going up in smoke? He thinks that his nephew Lot is dead. It was his concern for Lot that had led him to get in God's way in the previous chapter at the end. Abraham was reassured by God, if there are just 10 righteous in the city, Sodom will be spared. But Sodom has not been spared. Abraham sees this. Okay, so his concern was for Lot. That's why he was asking that Sodom is spared. But the city has gone up in smoke. But we know, and the author's already told us, the reader, that Lot has escaped. And what's going on here? There are two things I want to draw our attention to as we come towards the end. Sodom is destroyed and Lot is rescued. That's the first one. And the second one is God remembered Abraham and rescued Lot. Let's take one of these at a time. Sodom is destroyed and Lot is rescued. What's going on? What's with this? Well, in the next book of the Bible, God defines what his name, the Lord, means. The name that the writer of Genesis has been using for God. We read God describe himself as the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and the children's children to the third and the fourth generation. And what we need to notice is that there aren't two kinds of people referred to here, okay? How does God describe himself? As one who forgives iniquity and transgression and sin. Now, in order to need forgiveness, what do you have to be? You have to be guilty, right? So God describes himself as one who forgives the guilty, but one who will by no means forgive the guilty. Yeah? There's only one kind of person represented in God's self-disclosure of who he is. He's the God who forgives the guilty. And the God who will by no means forgive the guilty. He's the God who destroys Sodom and rescues Lot. There's only one kind of person in the story here in Genesis 19. There's the guilty. Lot is one of the men of Sodom. God's great revelation of who he is that he is the Lord who forgives the guilty and who will by no means forgive the guilty. He's the God who destroys Sodom, the guilty, and rescues Lot, the guilty. Abraham thought he could arrange for Lot's rescue on the basis of a few righteous people in Sodom, but there were no righteous there. But Abraham was still coming to know the nature of the Lord. He needn't have said, if there are 50 right, he didn't have gone through all of this. He could have just said, Lord, I love my nephew Lot, and I know he doesn't deserve it, but I don't want him to die. Will you rescue him? We don't understand it. We don't understand the nature of the Lord either until we see Jesus dying for us. This doesn't make any sense at all, does it? Until we see Jesus dying for us on the cross. When Jesus dies, in him, the guilty receive their punishment because he takes their punishment in their place. And in him, righteousness is credited to the guilty, not on the basis of their lack of guilt. For we all find ourselves among the men of Sodom, but because Jesus takes our punishment and gives us his righteousness. Nobody put it better than Paul in Romans 3, who said that God in Christ at the cross is both just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus. He's both just, Sodom is destroyed, and he's the justifier of the one who has faith in him. Lot is rescued. And look at how weak Lot's faith was. Look at how pathetic his faith is. Because the point is never the strength of your faith, but the one you're putting your faith in. Because our faith is a response to the faithfulness of the one who rescues us. What is Lot's faith? I would go so far as to say it's him finding himself rescued by the Lord. Finding himself having been made righteous, having been given righteousness. In Genesis 19, the guilty are punished and the guilty go free. At the cross, for those rescued by God, their sin is punished and they go free. Sodom is destroyed and Lot is rescued, but then secondly and finally, God remembered Abraham and rescued Lot. Now this is equally puzzling, isn't it? Because if God remembered Abraham, he would have remembered the conversation he had with him. He would have remembered Abraham's terms, Abraham's attempts to save the city of Sodom, Abraham's intercession, you could say, his prayer almost. But it isn't on Abraham's terms that Lot is rescued, is it? When you're reading around this chapter, it's very easy to end up saying, look at Abraham's great prayer, look at his great intercession. And because of that great intercession, God rescues Lot. And you think, well, yes and no. Because if it was just down to Abraham's great intercession, Lot would have died as Sodom went up in smoke because there weren't 10 people there. In one sense, Abraham's prayer wasn't answered because there weren't 10 righteous people there. The best way I've thought of to describe what's going on here is that God rescues Lot not on Abraham's terms, but for Abraham's sake. Knowing Abraham's great concern for his nephew Lot, God shows compassion to Lot. Here's Paul again in Romans. Who shall bring any charge against God's elect? It's God who justifies. Who is to condemn? Christ Jesus is the one who died. More than that, who was raised, who is at the right hand of God, and who indeed is interceding for us. So this is the question, friends. Is if God is so inclined to rescue Lot on the basis of Abraham's rubbishy intercession, how much more is God inclined to answer the prayer of his son, Jesus, who intercedes for us and says, Will you spare my people? God knows Abraham's great concern for his nephew Lot, and the Lord is compassionate. Abraham could have just told the Lord, "I love my nephew, please save him. I know he's an idiot, but please rescue him." God remembers Abraham, and in spite of Abraham's best efforts, not because of them, but in spite of Abraham's best efforts, God still rescues Lot. And that's because there is another intercessor, another advocate, one who knows the will of the Father and is as close as can be to the heart of the Father. Friends, Jesus is our Abraham in this sense. Jesus prays for us, and he does a much better job than Abraham. How much more secure can we be, knowing that Jesus is our perfect advocate? Again, in Hebrews we read, Jesus is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for us. We get a little glimpse of the kind of things Jesus prays for us in John 17. He prays that we would be one, an ambitious prayer. He prays that we would know the same love that Father and Son have always known, even from before the foundation of the world. And he prays acknowledging that his desire is that we would be with him where he is, to see his glory. Do you know today, friends, that Jesus is praying for you? What's my confidence for you today? It's that Jesus is making intercession for you. That Jesus is your advocate. Lot found himself rescued because God remembered Abraham, and the Lord, being merciful, brought him out of the city. Today, the Lord being merciful, we find ourselves rescued too, because God remembers Jesus. Please don't look back. Keep going. Instead, we're left saying, "Thank you for saving me, God. What can I say?" To finish our time together this morning, I'm going to play you a short video. It's a spoken word piece set to some nice music and some nice videography. And it picks up on some of the themes that we've been thinking about this morning. If you found yourself in the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, if you've seen yourself in Lot, in his daughters, in the men of Sodom, come with me to Jesus, the one who is both just and the justifier, the one who brings us out of the city, the one that we fix our eyes on as we run to him with no turning back.